Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in this half-hour segment, we're going to continue our discussion of the European Monetary Union. That's a very important subject, one that is not getting the discussion due it. In a previous half-hour segment, I analyzed the EMU as the realization of the theories of Friedrich Liszt, a pan-German theoretician who in the 1840s advocated a united Europe, an economically united Europe under German domination, as a vehicle for unseating Great Britain as the top power in the world. Great Britain is no longer the dominant power in the world, that's the United States. Otherwise, in my opinion, the European Monetary Union would appear to be the realization of the pan-Germanic theories of Friedrich Liszt. There was an article from the Financial Times of London from May 18th of 1998 that I read in the first segment, which sounds very much like the provision is being made to knuckle a bunch of heads in Europe in the event that the conflicts arise with regard to the European Monetary Union, and conflicts are in all likelihood going to arise. In fact, they're already beginning to arise. I would also note that there's very likely to be serious conflict between Europe and the United States as well. We're going to continue with a reading of a very important article about the EMU. It's entitled EMU and International Conflict. It's authored by Martin Feldstein, who is a professor of economics at Harvard University and is also president of the National Bureau of Economic Research. This article is from Foreign Affairs magazine and their issue of November and December of 1997, volume 76, number 6. By the way, Foreign Affairs is put out by the Council on Foreign Relations, and as such, this particular document could be viewed as the analysis of a considerable portion of the American elite, not necessarily what they will do in a policy sense, but this is an analysis which should not be too readily dismissed in terms of its weight within official circles. Continuing with this particular article, I'm going to overlap a few sentences with what I read in the previous section, in the previous half-hour segment. We're going to turn to a section of this article, and we're going to resume with our reading of the article, EMU and International Conflict, by Harvard professor Martin Feldstein. There's a section of the article entitled Taxes and Transfers. It reads, "Without the automatic countercyclical response of financial markets and the ability to use monetary policy to offset a decline in demand, European governments would want to use tax cuts and increases in government outlays to stimulate demand and reverse cyclical increases in unemployment. But the Stability Pact that was adopted under pressure from Germany tells governments that they cannot run fiscal deficits above 3% of GDP after the start of EMU. This restriction creates an important source of tension between countries with cyclical unemployment increases and the other members of the monetary union. The decision at the 1997 Amsterdam summit to weaken the application of financial penalties for violating this deficit ceiling would undoubtedly encourage more violations and therefore more quarrels about irresponsible, unquote, fiscal policies. Since national monetary and fiscal policies would be precluded, the most likely outcome of the shift to a single monetary policy would be the growth of substantial transfers from the EU to countries that experience cyclical increases in unemployment. Financing those transfers would require a significant increase in tax revenues collected by the EU. The debates about how large such transfers should be and how the taxes to finance them should be collected would exacerbate the more general disagreement that will inevitably arise as the Union seeks to restrict the level and structure of the taxes that individual countries must levy. The European Commission is already trying to get countries to move toward more coordination of their domestic tax policies on the grounds that existing differences in tax rates and rules create competitive advantages for some countries. The shift to a single currency would increase the pressure for tax harmonization. As general responsibility for economic policy shifts from national capitals to the European Commission, the European tradition of focusing taxing authority at a single level would be likely to lead to a shift of the exclusive taxing power from the national to the European level. The EU will therefore be disregarding national preferences about redistribution, the size of government, and the structure of taxes. While the pressures for such coordination might be overwhelming once a single currency has been adopted, the loss of national control over taxes and transfers would be another serious source of irritation within the EU. And the next section is called Long-Term Unemployment, and it reads, "As the decisions shift away from national governments, it will become harder to reach agreement on policy changes to deal with the high unemployment due to excessive regulation and social welfare payments. The shift of policy decisions from national governments to the European level would eliminate the ability to learn from the experiences of individual countries that tried different policies and to benefit from the competitive pressures to adopt national policies that succeed. Moreover, the changes in labor market rules and social benefits that have been proposed by certain national governments are now being opposed not only by labor unions within the individual countries, but also by other European governments that fear the resulting gains in competitiveness. Thus, we hear of opposition to, quote, social dumping, unquote, when an inefficient enterprise is closed, and witness the imposition of a Europe-wide limit on the number of hours that employees can work. A politically more unified Europe would make it easier to enforce policies that prevent changes in national labor laws or national transfer payments that would reduce structural unemployment and increase national competitiveness. If EU legislation succeeds in preventing member countries from competing with each other, they will collectively become less able to compete with the rest of the world. The result would undoubtedly be pressure for increased EU trade barriers, justified by reference to differences in social policy between Europe and other countries. European imposition of such protectionist policies would undermine the entire global trading system and create serious conflicts with the United States and other trading partners. The next section is entitled Incompatible Expectations. As the monetary union evolves into a more general political union, conflicts would arise from incompatible expectations about the sharing of power. France sees European monetary union and the resulting political union as a way of becoming a co-manager of Europe and an equal of Germany, which has nearly 50% more people. In the economic sphere, the current domination of European monetary policy by the Bundesbank would be replaced by that of the ECB, in which France and Germany would sit and vote as equals. As the French contemplate the eventual membership of the Economic and Political Union, they may also hope that their natural Mediterranean allies, Italy and Spain, will give France a decisive influence on European policies. And the skillful international French civil servants might come to dominate the administration of the European government. Germany's expectations and aspirations are more difficult to interpret. Some German leaders no doubt believe, as Chancellor Helmut Kohl frequently says, that joining a political union improves the prospects for peace by, quote, containing a potentially dangerous Germany within Europe, unquote. Other Germans are no doubt less self-sacrificing and simply disagree with the French assessment of the consequences of greater economic and political integration. They see Germany as the natural leader within the EU because of its economic weight, military capability, and central location in an EU that will soon include Poland, the Czech Republic, and Hungary. As Kohl has said, not without ambiguity, Germany is our fatherland, but Europe is our future, unquote. What is clear is that a French aspiration for equality and a German expectation of hegemony are not consistent. Both visions drive their countrymen to support the pursuit of EMU, and both would lead to disagreements and conflicts when they could not be fulfilled. The aspirations of the smaller countries to have a seat at the table may be frustrated as well. As the EU expands from 15 current members to include at least 6 more countries of Eastern Europe, the role that smaller countries will be allowed to play will become more and more limited. Current EU voting rules will give way to weighted voting arrangements in which the larger countries have a predominant share of the votes. This change will frustrate countries that recognize that they have sacrificed the ability to control their own domestic policies and their own foreign relations without having received in exchange an effective say in Europe's policies. This loss of sovereignty would affect not just monetary and tax policies, but a wide range of current domestic policies that will gradually come under the jurisdiction of the European Commission or European Parliament. Rulemaking by the European Commission reached a crescendo in 1994 with edicts about such things as the quality of beer and the permissible shape of imported bananas. A fear that complaints about bureaucratic meddling could jeopardize approval of the Maastricht Treaty in national referendums led to a reduction in rulemaking by the Brussels bureaucracy and a rhetorical emphasis on Maastricht's principle of, quote, subsidiarity, unquote, which asserts that activities will be assigned to whatever level of government is most appropriate, European, national, or local. There is, however, little reason to believe that this vague principle will do much to restrain the substitution of Brussels rules or Strasbourg legislation for what are now domestic policies. Even the 10th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which reserves to the states or to the people any powers not delegated to the national government, has not prevented the shift of power to the national government over an enormous range of local issues, such as speed limits on local roads and the age at which individuals may consume alcohol. The collapse of the Soviet Union has changed the basis for European foreign policy and military collaboration. This from a section called A European Military and Foreign Policy. Beginning the sentence, the section again. The collapse of the Soviet Union has changed the basis for European foreign policy and military collaboration. Although the United States and the countries of Western Europe have had an extremely close alliance since the end of World War II and continue to coordinate military efforts within the NATO structure, many Europeans in positions of responsibility see their economic interests and foreign policy goals differing from those of the United States with respect to many parts of the world, including Eastern Europe, the Middle East, Africa, and even Latin America. The French and German governments also want to develop an independent military capability that can operate without U.S. participation or consent. Although the European nations could now more readily pursue an independent foreign policy and military strategy, they are clearly hampered in doing so effectively by the decentralized political structure of Europe. Chancellor Konrad Adenauer summarized the situation in stark terms for French Foreign Minister Christian Pinault on the day in 1956 when England and France gave in to American pressure to abandon their attack on the Suez Canal. Quote, "France and England will never be powers comparable to the United States and the Soviet Union, nor Germany either. There remains to them only one way of playing a decisive role in the world. That is to unite to make Europe. England is not ripe for it, but the affair of Suez will help prepare her spirits for it. We have no time to waste. Europe will be your revenge." Unquote. That was a year before the Treaty of Rome launched the common market. And again, what Adenauer is talking about here is a European Union to basically unseat the United States. Continuing. The creation of a political union based on the EMU with explicit authority to develop a common foreign and defense policy would accelerate the development of an independent European military structure capable of projecting force outside Western Europe. Steps in that direction are already occurring in anticipation of the stronger political union that will follow the start of EMU. In March of 1997, on the 40th anniversary of the Treaty of Rome, France and Germany announced their desire to see a merger of the EU with the existing European military alliance, the Western European Union, so as to strengthen the military coordination of European nations outside the NATO framework. An explicit agreement was reached with the United States that will allow the European members of NATO to use European NATO forces and equipment under European control without U.S. participation. The attempt to forge a common military and foreign policy for Europe would be an additional source of conflict among the member nations, as well as with those outside the group. European countries differ in their national ambitions and in their attitudes about projecting force and influencing foreign affairs. An attempt to require countries like Portugal and Ireland to participate in an unwanted war in the Middle East or Eastern Europe could create powerful conflicts among the European nations. This next section is called The Risk of War. There is no doubt that a Europe of nearly 300 million people with an economy approximately equal in size to that of the United States could create a formidable military force. Whether that would be good or bad in the long run for world peace cannot be foretold with any certainty. A politically unified Europe with an independent military and foreign policy would accelerate the reduction of the U.S. military presence in Europe, weaken the role of NATO, and to that extent, make Europe more vulnerable to attack. The weakening of America's current global hegemony would undoubtedly complicate international military relationships more generally. Although Russia is now focusing on industrial restructuring, it remains a major nuclear power. Relations between Russia and Western Europe are important but unpredictable. Might a stronger Russia at some time in the future try to regain control over the currently independent Ukraine? Would a stronger, unified EU seek to discourage such action by force? Could that lead to war between Russia and the EU? How would a strong and unified Europe relate to other nations in the vicinity, including those of North Africa and the Middle East, and the Muslim states of the former Soviet Union, which are important or potential sources of energy for Western Europe? War within Europe itself would be abhorrent, but not impossible. The conflicts over economic policies and interference with national sovereignty could reinforce long-standing animosities based on history, nationality, and religion. Germany's assertion that it needs to be contained in a larger European political entity is itself a warning. Would such a structure contain Germany, or tempt it to exercise hegemonic leadership? That last sentence again. Would such a structure contain Germany, or tempt it to exercise hegemonic leadership? A critical feature of the EU in general, and the EMU in particular, is that there is no legitimate way for a member to withdraw. This is a marriage made in heaven that must last forever. But if countries discover that the shift to a single currency is hurting their economies, and that the new political arrangements also are not to their liking, some of them will want to leave. The majority may not look kindly on secession, either out of economic self-interest or a more general concern about the stability of the entire Union. The American experience with the secession of the South may contain some lessons about the danger of a treaty or constitution that has no exits. And the last section is called Implications for the United States. If, as seems most likely, EMU does occur and does lead to a political union with an independent military and foreign policy, the United States must rethink its own foreign policy with respect to Europe. First, the United States would have an opportunity to play a new, useful role within Europe, helping to balance national pressures and prevent the inevitable conflicts from developing into more serious confrontations. The United States should therefore emphasize that it wants its relations with the individual nations of Europe to remain as strong as they are today, and should not allow Brussels to intervene between Washington and the national capitals of Europe. Second, the United States must be aware that an economically and politically unified Europe would seek a different relationship with the United States. French officials in particular have been outspoken in emphasizing that a primary reason for a European monetary and political union is as a counterweight to the influence of the United States, both within European and in international affairs more generally. For the French, American influence is an old issue that frustrated de Gaulle and recurs in attacks on American cultural imperialism, unquote, and U.S. attempts to influence Europe's policy towards countries like Libya, Iraq, and Iran. Such issues would become more widespread in a powerful, independent Europe. Finally, the United States must recognize that it would no longer be able to count on Europe as an ally in all its relations with third countries. It was safe to assume such support when conflict with the Soviet Union dominated international relations, and Europe's interest in containing the Soviet Union coincided with America's. But the global configuration of relations is now more complex, and the Europeans, guided by a combination of economic self-interest, historical traditions, and national pride, may seek alliances and pursue policies that are contrary to the interests of the United States. Although this divergence may tend to happen in any case because of the apparent end of the Soviet threat, the creation of a monetary union that led to a strong political union would accelerate it. If the EMU occurs and leads to such a political union in Europe, the world would be a very different and not necessarily safer place. That, again, from Foreign Affairs Magazine's issue of November and December of 1997, I would note that union is in fact taking place. A warning from the Bundesbank, that's the central bank of Germany, that the euro is very likely to be a weak currency. And again, in the previously alluded to half-hour discussion of the European Monetary Union as the realization of the theories of Friedrich Liszt, a weak euro may very well destroy the U.S. economy by making an unnaturally strong dollar due to a flight to the dollar, which would choke off American manufactured exports by making them prohibitively expensive for people in other countries. Research credit on the following goes to a member of the audience. This from the Daily Telegraph of Great Britain. This is from the Electronic Telegraph of Sunday, March 28th of 1998. It's by Andrew Gimson, G-I-M-S-O-N, in Berlin. Bundesbank warning on new euro danger. The Bundesbank yesterday set itself at odds with the German government by voicing grave doubts about whether Italy and Belgium are fit to join the single European currency. The German Central Bank presented a pessimistic verdict on the process most members of the European Union have made in preparing for the euro, and said that only five had achieved a, quote, fiscal position that can unreservedly be classified as sustainable. This group consists of Britain and Denmark, both of which have refused to join in the first wave, Ireland, Finland, and Luxembourg. It excludes Germany and France, the two core members of the project. The bank's overall conclusion was that, quote, entry into monetary union from 1999 appears justifiable in stability policy terms, unquote, but it hedged this endorsement with a repeated exhortations for further action to improve finances. It said, quote, with regard to the requirement of a sustainable financial position, however, serious concern exists in the case of Italy and Belgium. This could be eliminated if additional firm substantive commitments are undertaken, unquote, Hans Tietmeyer, the bank's head, also refused to endorse yesterday's decision by the German cabinet to back a single currency launch with 11 members, including Italy and Belgium. And one of the criticisms that Tietmeyer pointed out is cited here, skipping down. But he added that the decisive point, unquote, was the very high debt in Italy and Belgium, currently over 120% of national wealth, which could only be tolerated if both countries entered into, quote, further obligations, unquote, to reduce it over the next 10 years to the Maastricht Treaty limit of 60%. And other warnings about the weak euro, also from the Electronic Telegraph of Britain, and also research credit on this goes to a listener, also by Andrew Gimson in Berlin, euro may, quote, sink like the Titanic, unquote. The launch of the euro was compared yesterday to the Titanic's fateful maiden voyage by Jean-Pierre Chevènement, the French interior minister. He told the German newspaper Die Woche, one can only pray and sing, unquote. And basically, due to the limitations of time, I'm not going to read this whole article. What Mr. Chevènement is saying is that basically the euro is going to be a weak currency because nations such as Belgium and Italy have not met the budgetary requirements. More about their failure to meet budgetary requirements. Research credit on this goes to Dave White, our pan-European researcher and translator. This from the London Daily Mail of Thursday, March 26th of 1998. It's by David Hughes, the Mail's political editor. It's called A Fudge, As First 11 Join the Euro Club, subtitled Creative Accounting Lets Countries Dodge Single Currency Rules. 11 countries will join the European single currency next January, even though at least three of them do not meet the membership requirements. They were, quote, nodded through, unquote, by the EU yesterday, despite the failure of Italy, Belgium, and Germany to meet strict monetary criteria laid down by the 1992 Maastricht Treaty. And more about the fudging of the euro criteria. Research credit on the following also goes to Dave White, our pan-European researcher and translator. This from the Daily Telegraph of Saturday, March 21st of 1998. It's an editorial by the Daily Telegraph. Italy doesn't add up. Its opening paragraph sums up the arguments. The decision to admit Italy to the European single currency has been so widely flagged in the press that it is almost impossible to turn back. It is now expected that the euro will go ahead with the full cast of 11 members, but it will be on the weakest of foundations before their disparate economies have been brought into alignment. The forthcoming reports of the European Monetary Institute and the German Bundesbank are expected to highlight the dangers, but they are unlikely to alter a political commitment made rashly long ago, as the European finance ministers meeting in York this weekend know full well. And the dangers of a weak euro to the United States and Britain, Britain for the time being outside of the European Monetary Union, were made in another article. This research credit on this also goes to a listener. This is from the Electronic Telegraph, again the Daily Telegraph of Britain, from March 26th of 1998. This is an article by George Jones and Toby Helm in Brussels. 11 countries given the go-ahead to join the EMU. And speaking of Tony Blair's decision not to join on the first wave, his decision not to intervene was attacked by senior Tories, including John Major and Norman Lamont, who as Prime Minister and Chancellor negotiated the convergence criteria in 1992. Mr. Major said he was, quote, very skeptical, unquote, that the countries had met the criteria. He said, quote, to accept that, you have to suspend belief. It is a triumph of creative accounting, unquote. He called on Mr. Blair to be prepared to challenge the EU's figures where they were wrong. He said, quote, "They should do so country by country, because the impact of a weak euro could be very damaging for Britain. It could force up the exchange rate of sterling and further damage manufacturing industry," unquote. Mr. Lamont said the Commission's recommendation showed the single currency was a purely political project, not an economic one. He said, quote, "A monetary union built on fudged criteria is dangerous and will make a single currency more difficult to operate," unquote. And the problem of creating a stronger currency, and this was contained, by the way, in the article from Foreign Affairs, is that countries would have to spend on job creation, and this would make their annual budget deficits more than 3% of gross domestic product, and that makes them unacceptable from the standpoint of euro qualification. And one of the major problems is that right now, in many European countries, including Germany and France, there is very, very high unemployment. And this is likely to continue because in order to meet the austerity requirements of the European Monetary Union, they will have to forego large-scale spending on job creation, which will foster continued unemployment. And that unemployment, in turn, it should be noted, is fostering sentiment for fascism. Going to reprise a section of an article that I read earlier. Research credit on the following goes to Dave White, our pan-European researcher and translator, who got this from the Daily Mail of Tuesday, April 28th of 1998. It's an article called "Why I Fear Germany's New Nazis." It's by Niall Ferguson, F-E-R-G-U-S-O-N, of Jesus College at Oxford, and it reads in part as follows. The temptation for British observers is to conclude that, quote, alluding to the recent electoral success of many Nazis, of the Deutsche Volksunion in Saxony-Anhalt, the temptation for British observers is to conclude that, quote, the bloody Germans never change. But that is too crude. The rise of neo-Nazism in Rust Belt towns has to be understood as a Europe-wide phenomenon. Indeed, as a phenomenon which the European Union is unwittingly fostering. By the way, I would say I would give some serious thought to the unwitting qualification. Skipping down. Finally, those high unemployment figures in Saxony-Anhalt are part of a wider problem of labor market inflexibility, which is as much European as it is German. And it talks about the high unemployment in places like France, which are fueling the popularity of the Front National of Jean-Marie Le Pen. And also uncertainty about the dissolution of the Deutschmark is creating uncertainty about in Germany, which in turn is creating sentiment for far-right parties. Even if the euro turns out to be a strong currency, it bodes poorly for the United States. We haven't got time to discuss it in this program, but analysts have warned that if the euro is a strong currency, it could replace the dollar as the reserve currency of choice, and that in turn could be devastating to the U.S. economically by eliminating the dollar as the reserve currency of choice. That, however, will have to wait for another discussion. That concludes this half-hour segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.